On this week's episode of Video Culture, we'll talk sword and sorcery with Lady Hawk and Excalibur.
Did you rewind it?
I don't know.
In a time where everyone has a podcast. In a place where everyone has an opinion. Two heroes, Matthew and Ryan, against all odds, are here to save your movie viewing experience from total disaster. Your trip through the video aisles of yesteryear begins now. There will be chills. There will be thrills, and there's a good chance that Ryan will have a coffee spill. They'll discuss the quality, cultural significance, and more detail, frankly, than you bargained for. Here's your host, Ryan Acree and Matthew Essery.
And thank you, Andy Morris, for that wonderful intro. I'm your host for Video Culture, Ryan Acree.
And I'm Matthew Essery.
And welcome to another week of two fantastic movies. And like I mentioned in the intro, as always, Lady Hawk and Excalibur. Mm-hmm. Sword and sorcery. Dark Ages.
Fantasy. Times of high adventure.
Yes. It was, we kind of came up with the idea of doing this, that we needed to do another like genre type. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we covered Westerns. We've kind of done some sci-fi.
Yeah.
We've kind of done some macho men, action movies.
We've done some action movies. Yeah. We've done some comedies.
Yeah.
We've done some romantic comedies. And we wanted to get into one of those kind of video store staple genres. And I don't know about you, but I always remember as a kid going into video stores and seeing like these VHS box covers with like these ornately painted like fantasy covers of like muscular men fighting dragons with like scantily clad women at their feet, and thinking, man, I bet that movie's really cool.
Yeah.
And usually they're not. Usually they're pretty terrible.
Yeah, but I mean, they're kind of like dime store like fantasy versions of, but, and it always involves a princess or a prince, and you know, sometimes
wizards and dragons and
some guy with his shirt off at some point in the movie.
Yeah. And but the movies are never quite as cool as the covers look. But there are some good movies in that in that genre. There's of course Conan the Barbarian.
Yeah.
And I think the two movies we're talking about today qualify as two good movies in that genre.
Yeah, I mean, there's even like Clash of the Titans.
Well, Clash of the Titans. I think that counts.
Yeah, because it's like fantasy, you know, mystical, like anything dealing with that. I mean, and the beloved sort of cult classic in this like sort of genre is also The Highlander.
In a way, it's definitely adjacent. Beastmaster, the first Beastmaster.
Okay, yeah.
That's a good one.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
But these are also like two sort of like, you know, I wouldn't say like top shelf. They're like middle shelf, you know, kind of cult classics, if you will.
They're not movies you hear a lot of people talk about nowadays, which makes them perfect for what we do.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, we like rediscovering these things. But there were movies that were, at least one of them was a big part of my childhood.
Right. So you actually, Lady Hawk, so it's starring Matthew Broderick. And you actually saw this movie a lot when you were growing up.
Yeah, it was on TV a lot. I played Dungeons & Dragons as a kid. I'm one of those kids. I rolled a lot of multi-sided dice.
Yeah.
And one of the movies that me and my friends thought was kind of a quintessential D&D movie was Lady Hawk.
Right.
So, you know, it played a lot when we were kids. You know, I had a friend who had it on videotape. We watched it a lot. I mean, kind of, again, one of these kind of movies we should be talking about on this show.
Well, before we get into it then, tell what, like, when you were that age, like, what was so appealing about Lady Hawk?
The idea of, like, brave heroes and cool sword battles and beautiful damsels and, like, this nerdy kid getting to be a hero. Mm-hmm. And just, yeah, something I've always thought, like, you know, knights and wizards were kind of cool. Right. I don't know why. I think this is interesting and innate in most geeky kids. I think that stuff's kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Something about the idea of, you know, real of being heroic and being brave and battling monsters and that kind of stuff. It's just, it's very primal. It's like, for some reason, kids like Star Wars. I mean, Star Wars is basically a fantasy movie in space.
Yeah, I mean, but, I mean, audiences are obviously, like, accustomed to, you know, things like fantasy and, you know, curses, because we've had, like, cartoons like Sleeping Beauty, Cinderella, you know, Rapunzel. Yeah. I mean, these are all, like, sort of things that would be, if they were live action, they would kind of fit into this, yeah, this same would. Category.
Just a little more lurid. Like, right. Like I said, there's a little bit more bloodshed and violence.
Yeah, this was more like the knights are, like, swords and, like, people with armor and,
Yeah, but there are witches and wizards and curses and, you know, again, beautiful damsels. And that's all tropes of the genre. You know, brave heroes, dastardly villains, monsters to be slain.
All right, so let's get into it. As I mentioned before, Matthew Broderick plays one of the main characters, which is Philip Gaston. And he is a young thief known as the Mouse. And IMDb... John Vogel writes that Philip Gaston, a thief, escapes from the dungeon Aquila, sparking a manhunt. He is nearly captured when Captain Navarre befriends him. Navarre has been hunted by the bishop's men for 2 years, ever since he escaped the Lady Isabeau, who the bishop has lusted after. Navarre and Isabeau have a curse that the bishop has placed on him that curses Navarre to be a wolf during the night and Isabeau to be a hawk during the day. Navarre insists that Philippe help him re-enter the city to help him kill the heavily guarded bishop. So, I mean, yeah, so that's, yeah, because like one of the scenes, like you open up, like he's escaping, like this jail, and then he gets kind of get cornered by all the men that are going to capture him. And then Navarre steps in to save him, and you don't know why. You don't find out until much later.
And to clarify, Navarre is played by the great late Rutger Hauer, who sadly passed away in 2019.
Yes.
You know, from Blade Runner, Batman Begins, Blind Fury, so many great genre movies. I mean, Rutger Hauer, to me, he's like one of the video store royalty. We talk about video store royalty. Rutger Hauer is video store royalty.
Right.
And Isabeau is played by Michelle Pfeiffer.
Yeah. And this is one of the early Michelle Pfeiffer movies. And actually, I had to go and look it up, and I'll go ahead and spoil the riches now that, like, she actually made... So, this movie came out in 1985. So, she only made two movies in 1985, and the other one was Into the Night.
So, this is sort of a sequel episode to our... Into the Night episode, which you can find in our archives at video-culture.com.
Yeah.
Go check it out. You can have a little podcastable feature to go with our audio-able feature.
Yeah, so sorry, Michelle. We're covering her whole, like, 1985, like, filmography here. Yeah. She's having to, like, relive all of these, like, things. So this is what she was up to in 85, so at least we know.
So, yeah, the movie opens with Matthew Broderick escaping from this prison, this medieval prison. He's rescued by Rutger Hauer's character, and he basically gets wrapped up in this fairy tale story about this knight who becomes a wolf during the day, and his lady love becomes a wolf at night, and his lady love becomes a hawk during the day. So they never are human at the same time together because they're cursed by an evil bishop.
Right, but we don't know at first why Navarre like helped Philippe escape or like kind of took him under his wing. Yeah. Until like 20 minutes or 25 minutes in the movie. And then you realize, like, well, you broke out of there. I need to get back in because I want to kill the bishop.
Yeah.
And because the bishop is the one who set this curse on me. And so he wants to, you know, get inside and.
Yeah, it's basically like a fairy tale action story. It's got a lot of fairy tale tropes. It's a little bit Princess Bride-y in a way.
It is very Princess Bride-y. I mean, I immediately thought of that when I was like. Especially when you find out, like, the hawk and the love story between the two of them and how they can never see each other because they are, you know, and here I am with my voice again, just like last week.
It's
okay. But, yeah, here they are. They're like, in love, but they can, because the bishop also like, was in love with Isabeau, he cursed both of them to where, you know.
Yeah. And I like how the magic is never really explained. It's just like, oh, he just cursed him because that's what you do in medieval times. Well, you give curses.
He was a bishop.
Yeah.
I mean, of course he has magical powers, right?
Yeah, yeah.
He can just summon, you know, magic, right?
Yeah, but, they never explain how it works or how he did it or how it's even broken. It just is. And I kind of like that fairy tale aspect of it.
Right. And I love the old guy, like the monk that they meet, like in the ruined castle.
Yeah,
like,
the monk who basically tells them how to break the curse.
Yeah, he kind of like is kind of like their sort of like soothsayer, basically, and tells them how you can break it. Like it has to be a day without night and night without day or like whatever. Yeah.
Which basically in the film is an eclipse.
Right. It's an eclipse, but like you don't really find that out until the end. And then, you know.
Yeah, they live happily ever after.
Yeah.
But let's talk about Lila, like what makes this movie interesting.
Okay.
First thing I think is it's directed by Richard Donner.
Right.
Richard Donner did a lot of movies that you and I care about. He directed the Lethal Weapon series.
He directed The Omen, the Superman 1978.
Exactly.
The Goonies, Scrooged, Lethal Weapon, and X-Men.
No, he did not direct X-Men.
Yes, he did.
No, his wife produced X-Men.
Oh, his wife produced X-Men. No.
Yeah.
Well, okay.
Yeah, I promise.
I digress.
But yeah, that's an amazing list of things he actually did direct. You're right with everything but the last one. That's an amazing list.
I'll go back and check my notes. I apologize.
It's okay. Okay. But no, even if you take X-Men off that list, that's an impressive directorial resume.
Right. I mean, and that's where a lot of people know Richard Donner is from the Goonies. Even though it is part of Amblin Entertainment and it was produced by Steven Spielberg, he got Donner to direct it.
Yeah. Well, and Superman, man, that's an amazing film.
Yes.
And Scrooge, one of the best Christmas movies of all time.
Right. And we're talking about the Christopher Reeve Superman.
Yes, 1978.
Yeah, the original one.
Yeah.
Not Superman 2 or Superman 3.
Yeah. The original one. You'll believe a man can fly. That's an excellent film. So, yeah, he directed it. I mean, it's got a great cast. I mean, Rutger Hauer, again, to me, is royalty. Michelle Pfeiffer is luminous in this film.
Mm-hmm.
It's got Matthew Broderick having fun. He's kind of the weak link, but he's still fun in it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, well, what do you, like, you were telling me that you thought he felt like he lost his accent a few times during the film.
Yeah, I mean, Matthew, I thought it was really interesting how, I mean, he did Ferris Bueller's Day Off in, what, like 1984, I guess was, and this was 85. Yeah. Or no, he did it in 86. It was like 1 year after. So, but I thought it was interesting. He kept talking to himself. Like, he didn't talk to himself. He prayed, right? He was talking to God, but he still had that, like almost like he was talking to himself.
He's basically talking to himself, but just using God as an excuse.
Right. And so that was like really interesting. So it was almost like he was sort of revisiting his, you know, Ferris Bueller character before Ferris Bueller was ever created. But you can definitely tell he's an American trying to cop a English accent because number one, the English accent, even when he pulled it off, wasn't that great.
No.
And then he kept going like in and out of it.
It was a little Monty Python-esque.
Yeah.
And that's not the only time we're going to reference that this show for sure. But no. Still, it's a fun movie. I mean, it's not that nice to look at. It's kind of an ugly film.
I did have a few problems with it, though. I'll tell you what I didn't like about it.
What did you like about it?
I didn't like all this. It was like they were together, and it was like they had a plan, and they would get separated, but then they would all be together again, like, out of nowhere. You know, it's like, oh, you're going to leave and go to this place, so I'm going to separate, you know, from you, but then after that, we're all going to be together. So it was like, it was like really kind of strange in that way. And then the other thing that was weird that I didn't like, and probably I probably wouldn't notice had I not watched as many movies as I did, like, this past year, but the cinematography was really inconsistent.
It's kind of an ugly film. That's what I was saying.
Well, it had some pretty scenes. It did have some beautiful scenes of the countryside. Mm-hmm. But it also had some, like, you know, dark scenes, and it had some, like, really shady. So it just had a very inconsistent look to it that almost like you had two different, you know, directors or three different directors of photography.
It didn't feel cohesive.
Yeah, it just seemed rather sort of spliced together, no yeah. real thinking about how each of the lighting worked with everything.
I could totally see that, yeah.
Yeah.
It's not perfect by any means, but what makes to me what makes it good is, again, the Rutger Hauer and Michelle Pfeiffer are both really good in it. Because they're both great actors, and they really nail kind of the kind of arch speech that they're mm-hmm. required to use. They really feel like their characters. They excel where Broderick kind of stumbles.
Yeah, they really pick up the film where Broderick is just kind of to the side. You know yeah. what I mean? And I don't think it's one of Broderick's like better performances either.
You know what I mean? Really tell that he didn't do a lot. He didn't do a lot of accents after this movie for sure.
Right.
But it's still fun. It's very light. It's a very simple movie.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not super involved. I mean, the costuming is nice. The choreography of the fight scenes is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
There's lots of little period details that I really kind of enjoy. One thing I really appreciate about Lady Hawk is the sword fights look like they take effort.
Mm-hmm.
And I mentioned this to you before off air, but I love the detail about when Rutger Hauer is having his final sword fight at the end. He's wearing his full like armor. He's right. being all badass fighting the bad guys. Mm-hmm. And then he takes off his helmet and he's drenched in sweat. And that is so rare to see in a movie where a character physically exerts themselves in a fight scene for them to sweat. Mm-hmm. And he's entirely sweaty for the last 15 minutes of the movie as he's acting, as he's being happy, mm-hmm. as he's having his happily ever after moment. He's still just sweaty because he just fought a bunch of bad guys. That's a nice little detail that they didn't have to do. But I really enjoyed that after being a guy who's seen so many of these kind of movies. That little detail, that's it's not necessary, but I appreciate it because it added to the idea of the realism of the moment.
Even though there was fantasy.
Yes.
That it was appreciated. I get where you're coming from, that it wasn't just all like sort of contrived and everything yeah. is perfect and everything is like happily ever after. Like he's yeah. a real like sort of person.
Yeah. You know, it gave like, it a bit of reality.
Yeah. No, I totally get you.
Which is something the other film does, which we'll get into, but the other film does that pretty well too, with the way it handles the sword fights.
Yeah.
I
just thought that it was a really sort of simple story.
Yeah.
That if they, it's only about, what, an hour and a half long? Or
It's about an hour and 50.
Yeah. And if you really, it's almost like they had to complicate the story a little bit to yeah. take out, like, it was too simple to do in just, like, one movie. So they had to, felt like they were scrambling to add more things yeah. in there.
Like at some point, Isabeau, Michelle Pfeiffer's character, gets hurt as a bird, so she has to be recuperated.
Right. And there was a whole scene where the wolf, like the drowns. And
yeah, where he almost drowns as a wolf. And then they introduce a villain character who's not in it very long, played by Alfred Molina from mm-hmm. Indiana, from Raiders of the Lost Ark in Spider-Man
mm-hmm.
2,
mm-hmm.
who plays a trapper, a wolf trapper. Hired by the bishop to try to catch
right.
Rutger Hauer when he's in wolf form. And he's just kind of like a little sub-boss, like a little mini bad guy. He's in it like 15 minutes, but he makes a pretty good impression.
Yeah.
He gets a cool destiny. He gets his head caught in a wolf trap.
Well, I mean, in his own trap. I mean, he's yeah. had all these wolf traps and then
he falls in one, basically. Yeah, like a putz.
Yeah, yeah exactly.
But like, yeah, it's a surprisingly bloodless movie. There's not much blood in it.
Mm-mm.
I think you could show this to someone who's maybe 10 years old and have them really be into it.
Yeah, some of the fight scenes and some of like the language and stuff like that. But I mean, just the tone. But other than that, yeah.
Yeah. Like I don't remember a lot of bad language. I mean, it just felt to me like just a rollicking kind of movie.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's like I said, it's not super light, but it's definitely not heavy.
Right.
It's kind of in that between of being sort of, whimsical, but having stakes.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. But there are like a couple of death scenes.
Yeah.
Like the trap kind of gets a little.
Oh, yeah. That's
and
true.
And then the king or the bishop at the end. And
oh, yeah. The bishop does get stabbed through the chest with a big sword.
Yeah.
As all bad guys should.
Right. Yeah, I mean, but this is one of the movies that, like you said, that you watched over and over and over. Like,
I saw it a few times when I was a kid. Right. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, I guess I missed it. I wasn't whether I didn't play HBO or like I didn't like wasn't into it.
What's surprising about it because you're a big Matthew Broderick fan. You love war games,
right?
And so I figured you just knew this movie because this came out a couple years later. I figured you just knew this movie.
84, yeah,
That was surprising when you said you hadn't seen it.
Yeah, this was kind of the movie he did in between War Games and Ferris Bueller. And yeah, I was surprised that I hadn't seen it either. I guess maybe I tried to watch it. Maybe I watched it as a kid and just forgot about it. But it
entirely
was just
possible.
Like, yeah, it was just kind of weird. Like, I wasn't into that sort of like wizard and sorcery at that age. Yeah. Like, I was, you have to remember, I'm a little bit older than you. So, like, that was kind of like
past. I remind you all the time.
Well, I mean, even when The Princess Bride came out, like, girls I knew, like, kind of liked it more than I did. You know what I mean? Like, I thought that was like, not, you know, I was like kind of more trying to get into more macho things, you know. Yeah.
Well, man.
Yeah, right.
But anyway, a funny observation I had about this movie. They show a scene where Rutger Hauer turns into the wolf, and he's running in slow motion, and he turns into the wolf. It's a neat little practical effects scene, but he takes his clothes off as he's changing.
Yeah.
So what I couldn't help but wonder, is he's running around as this wolf. When he wakes back up again, does he have to go find his clothes every time? That's got to be annoying, you know?
Yeah, and then when he gets out of the... doesn't he get out of the lake, like the frozen lake, and then they have to put clothes on him or something like that?
Well, they wrap him in furs to kind of keep him warm.
Right.
But, I mean, just how annoying would that be to be a shapeshifter to constantly go find your pants, you know?
Yeah. Well, that was... Oh, that was the thing about Isabeau, too, remember? Like, she had... Like, he had to get her clothes, like they were in the barn or whatever.
Yeah.
And he had to get her clothes.
Okay, well, what an annoying existence that must be. You have to constantly track down your trousers.
Like, yeah, exactly. Yeah. all right, so let's move on to Excalibur.
Which came out, I believe, in 1981?
1981, very good. Produced by John Borman, who also directed Point Blank, Deliverance, Zardoz. You were talking about Zardoz.
Zardoz is a weird movie, but Point Blank and Deliverance?
Yeah, Point Blank, Deliverance, and The Exorcist 2.
That's not a bad movie, but those first three, that's a resume.
Yeah. Point Blank, Deliverance. Yeah, exactly. For sure.
I mean,
for sure.
Those first two are stone cold classics.
Well, this one was kind of seen like he felt like he needed to come back after Exorcist 2. Because Exorcist 2, when it came out, it was not as well received as The Exorcist, and it was actually quite a failure.
Yes. Yes, it was.
All right.
Maybe we'll talk about those at some point. That might be something to do one day.
Yeah, I like those series. Yeah, I like The Exorcist. I had a friend of mine. Side note that he was really into those movies, like The Exorcist and Reagan, and he like watched them all. He loved them.
Wild.
Anyway, yeah, weird.
But
okay. So, but this is all like King Arthur.
Yeah, it is just straight up King Arthur, Lord of the Britons. You know, Excalibur, Lady in the Lake, Percival, Lancelot, Guinevere, Morgana, Merlin.
Yeah.
You know, it's all the stuff you know. Like, literally, even as people who aren't big into Arthurian legend in America, like, I knew all these stories. Even though I don't think I've actually read any King Arthur legends, but I just knew everything that was going to happen in this film because it's just so ingrained in pop culture.
Yeah, like the Sword and the Stone and Merlin and, like you said, like the Lady in the Lake and... like all those things, like the Knights of the Round Table and Search for the Holy Grail. And, you know, this movie is not like to be an historical accuracy.
No, it is.
All.
It is not in any way.
It is meant to be a sort of legendary or, you know, fantasy.
It is straight up fantasy.
Yeah, right.
Exactly. Everything about it.
Like, like the mythos of Arthur.
Yeah.
You know, sort of.
Yeah.
Perspective.
And nothing about it is historical at all. The way they dress, the way they talk, things that happen. It is pure fantasy.
Right.
It might as well be, you know, completely made. They might as well be wearing space suits. It's so fantastical.
Yeah. It's all like based upon a group of tales called Le Meurtre d'Arthur.
Very nice job.
Oh, thanks. Which means the death of Arthur.
Mm.
So yeah. Well, I mean, Acre is kind of like a French like name, or it's
So is Estrie, believe it or not.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. No wonder we get along.
Yeah.
All right. So we're getting too caught up in our side notes.
Yeah.
So let's just go like so. Nigel Terry plays King Arthur. It's like a bunch of British people. I mean, it's like all English actors. Yeah. Like, there's no. like American actor, I think, at all in these, mm-hmm. this movie.
I think it's mostly Irish actors.
Yeah, Irish and English. So Nigel Terry plays King Arthur. Helen Mirren, a young Helen Mirren, as Morgana Le Fay, which is like King Arthur's like half sister, I guess.
Yes. She's sort of the Joker to King Arthur's Batman.
Yeah. And then Nicolas Cage, like, let's see, who else is in this? Paul Jeffrey is Percival.
Yeah.
Gabriel, but see, Gabriel Byrne is in this movie. It was
when you get into the smaller cast, that's when the names get really interesting. Gabriel Byrne as Uther, King Arthur's father. A very young Gabriel Byrne.
Right. Patrick Stewart.
Patrick Stewart. Liam Neeson.
Liam Neeson. A young Liam Neeson. Yeah. Yeah.
And they're just in this movie. Like I remember watching it. I was like, is that Gabriel Byrne?
Yeah.
Is that Patrick Stewart? That's Liam Neeson.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we were talking about this before in pre-production. It's like, it's almost like English actors. It's like they do, you know, to really become an actor, right? Yeah. They have to do Shakespeare, you know, and if they do Shakespeare, then they do some sort of like King Arthur, like knight, you know, thing. Yeah. And, you know, this was the thing. This was the knight thing to do. You know what I mean? So a lot of people, even Pierce Brosnan, tried out for this movie.
Really?
You know? Yeah.
So, he would fit right in.
Right. He didn't make it in, you know, at the time. I mean, who knows? I don't know how old he was or why he got turned down. But, yeah, it's like a lot of people wanted to be in this movie.
Yeah. So basically, man, it's just, like I said, it's just the King Arthur stories from basically his birth up until his death.
Right.
So, are you ready for my take on this movie?
Yeah, go ahead. Well, wait a second. Do you want me to read?
Do we need the synopsis for this one?
Yes.
Okay.
For those that may not know, the myth of King Arthur brought once again to the screen. Uther Pendragon, played by Gabriel Byrne, is given the mystical sword Excalibur by the wizard Merlin. At his death, Uther buries the sword into a stone until the next man that can pull it out will be the King of England. 7 years later, Arthur, Uther's bastard son, draws Excalibur and becomes king. Guided by Merlin, Arthur marries Guinevere and gathers the Knights of the Round Table. Arthur's evil half-sister, Morgana, sires a son with him who may prove to be his downfall.
So that leads me into my take on this movie. Ryan, this is the horniest night movie I've ever seen in my life. Like,
I mean, there are a couple nude scenes.
Literally, every major plot point is motivated by someone wanting to have sex with a pretty lady.
Well, yeah. I mean, Sir Lancelot wants to be with Guinevere. I mean, the whole thing starts off with, what is his name?
Gabriel Byrne's Uther.
Yeah, Uther, like, wants this other king's, like, you know, wife. And Merlin's like, are you sure about that? Well, if you have an heir, then it's mine. And he's like, okay, whatever. I want her. And so he's like, all right. So it makes
I'll give up my kingdom for this.
Right. And then, like, magical myth, you know, stuff happens. And then, like, boom. And then that's who Arthur was.
Well, and let's not brush through the fact that basically Merlin aided a medieval date rape is what happened.
Yeah.
He basically helped Uther disguise himself to get with this.
Using black magic
to basically trick this lady into sleeping with Uther. It starts off really weird. And Uther has sex wearing his full armor.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Like, I guess maybe,
with the daughter, like, just nearby. Like, and it's, like, just right over there.
Yeah, I guess maybe he just kind of took, like, the cod piece off to make this happen. I don't want to get to the mechanics of it. It's the weirdest image of him, like, grinding on this girl wearing full armor.
Right, well, the whole idea was, like death. Like, they went off, like, the king's men that, like, the wife, right?
Yeah.
That he was taking.
Yeah.
Was off in battle, like, to go, you know, to go kill the Uther's men. So they're making this connection between, like, Uther and this other king. And it's almost like that's why he got in.
Yeah.
That's why he, like, because they were like, oh, the king is back. And they just, like, let him in. So, like, everybody thought he was this other king. Yeah. And they're, like, making some connection between, like, death and, like,
life or
life and sex or something like that. Like, I don't know.
But it's just the weirdest. It's like 10 minutes in the movie. You got this guy in full armor, like grinding old woman. It's like the weirdest. Like, I'm like, I remember sitting there on my couch being like, what am I watching right now?
Yeah. And the woman's nude and he's just like totally wearing all of his armor.
Yeah. He's like full medieval times, you know, like cable guy, you know, shield and helmet kind
of. I mean, if that's the only weird thing you have with the movie, I mean, there's a lot of other
there's so much
weird stuff in this movie that we can't even get into.
Yeah.
But the one thing that, like, you know, but even so, like, then he marries, like, then, you know, Arthur gets the sword and the stone, and he becomes king of the Britons, or not, they didn't even say the Britons. No, he just says, like, of the
king
land.
King of the land, yeah.
So, and then, you know, they have the castle and, like, the Knights of the Round Table. But then Lancelot, like, he finds Lancelot. They kind of have a little battle. And
where they became friends, because that's what you do in these movies. You fight and you become friends.
Right, It's like, oh, you're a formidable foe. Okay. And then I'll take you in as a, you know, Knight of the Round Table or whatever.
Yeah.
But no, it's because he asked the Lord for help. You know, to slay, you know, Lancelot.
Yeah.
And then so he got rebuked and it, like, broke Excalibur in half or whatever.
And he had to reforge. There's all these little weird details.
Yeah, and then he apologizes and, like, prays, and then, like, he gets it back. So he asks Lancelot to be on his, you know, Knights of the Round Table. Yeah. But then Lancelot's, like, in love with Guinevere.
Even though they never really talk.
No, he's just, like, he just sees her. He's like, yeah, I'm in love with you.
And she's like, I love you, too.
Yeah, like...
Okay. We're going to go have sex in the woods without any clothes on, and it's weird.
Right.
This whole movie is really stagey looking.
Yes.
Like, it could be a stage play. Mm-hmm. It looks like a really expensive stage play.
Yeah. And everything is like that, too. Everything is like, oh, we're going to do this scene, and then we're going to do this scene. Yes. It's like, this explains this part of Arthur's story. Yeah. This explains this part of Arthur's story. Yeah. So there's these huge jumps and gaps in time.
It's very like... fragment. It's like King Arthur's greatest hits. It just jumps from, like, moment to moment with no connective tissue.
Yeah,
and what makes it work is it's nice to look at. Yes, it looks stagey. Everything looks like sets, even when they're on location. But at least it's nice to look at. They have beautiful costumes, but the movie just is kind of fragmented in the way it jumps around.
Well, we have to talk about the look. When I first put this movie on, I, like, put it on, and I'm watching the battle scenes, and I'm, like, watching things because I've never seen this movie.
Yeah, I hadn't either. Yeah.
And I was like, holy crap, this looks like a lot like Monty Python and the Holy Grail, which is also about Arthur. And I was like, wait. And I stopped the movie. When was this made? 81. When was, you know, Monty Python and the Holy Grail made? 75.
Yeah, 75.
Wait, what? This is, like, 5 years later?
Yeah.
And they have such a similar look to each other.
And even moments in the film, and I know it's all King Arthur's legend, but if you, like, I said this a little bit earlier, but if he has shown me these two movies side by side, like, if I watched Monty Python and the Holy Grail and Excalibur side by side in a double feature, you didn't tell me which one came out first, I would assume that Monty Python and the Holy Grail was a Naked Gun-esque parody of Excalibur.
Exactly. Because
it has all the same moments in it.
Right.
The look is incredibly similar. Mm-hmm. The dialogue is pretty similar, and it made the entire movie kind of hard to watch because I wanted to make Monty Python jokes to myself as it was going on.
Well, I mean, it's the same, like, Arthur stories, like the legendary stories.
Even visually, like the way the movie is shot looks a whole lot like Holy Grail.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was always in the back of my mind just thinking of imagery from that movie.
Yeah, I mean, I would hear, like, the horses, like... like, run, and you hear...
You'd imagine, like, the coconuts,
you know, and you see people, like, wallering in the mud, and, like, you're not my king, he's not my king, and you're like, oh, my gosh, this is so...
And when the lady, you know, like, actually threw the sword, I kept thinking, a watery tart lobbing scimitars, you know? And that's a disservice to Excalibur, because Excalibur's, it's a pretty cool movie. I mean, like, it's got cool visuals. The fight scenes are neat.
Yeah.
Like, the armor is gorgeous.
Oh God, that is, like, the greatest looking armor. I don't know if it's, I doubt it's historically accurate at all. It looks like it, I know it's made out of aluminum, which they really didn't use. But yeah, I mean, it looks gorgeous.
Well, I didn't know if you had this in your notes. So I didn't bring it up yet. But you know, a lot of those designs for the armor were not made for this movie. Okay.
Coming up later.
Okay.
All right, don't spoil it.
We'll get to that later.
Spoiler, don't spoil it.
We'll get to that later.
All right.
But yes, the armor is beautiful, and they wear it constantly in the movie.
Yeah, like even when they're sitting around the round table, they're still wearing like the armor.
They're like eating dinner in full armor.
Right. Like, they would not just do this. Like, everywhere they went, they were wearing this armor. No, you only wear the armor like when you're in battle or like when you're about to go to...
Yeah, but you can tell they were intensely proud of their costumes.
Right.
But like even like the capes they wore looked really nice.
Well, and even like the jousting scene about like the whole thing about like professing the... like
defending Guinevere's honor?
Yeah, defending Guinevere's honor.
Yeah.
This is all like before the age of chivalry and all of that stuff too. So this is before all of that. Like we were in... This is like the Dark Ages where it was like... You know, mob rule, basically, almost.
Yeah, basically, everything in the movie wouldn't have actually existed in the Dark Ages at all.
No.
It's all just, again, it's basically fairy tale again.
Yeah.
But it's very, you know, it's very lurid. It's violent. It's bloody. There's lots of nudity.
There's a couple of nude scenes.
A lot of nudity in it.
Just a couple of nude scenes.
Rewatch. There's a lot of.
Oh, there was not.
I watched it this morning. There's a lot of nudity.
Nah.
I mean, no one hangs dong in it or anything.
Oh, okay.
But, yeah.
Oh.
But I mean,
there may be a naked man butt somewhere.
There's more than one. it's weird because the movie looks really nice. Like the costumes are beautiful. It looks expensive. But yet, also at the same time, it looks sort of cheap, too.
Yeah.
Because the scenes aren't that fully populated with people. Like, there's only so many knights. There's only so many bad guys. There's only so many peasants. So we got these people in ornate costumes, on ornate sets, and there's like five people in the scene.
Right. And unlike Lady Hawk, this movie, whoever the director of photography was, did a fantastic job because... The scenes look incredible.
Yes.
They look really well for you know, the type of film stock and you know, the cameras and things like that that they were using back in 81.
Yeah, because it wasn't the nicest film stock. It's grainy, but the cinematography really overcomes that and still, I mean, the movie's a pleasure to look at.
Yeah, like the outdoor scenes and the water scenes. I mean, everything looks like really green and lush. It looks like England, you know, would have sort of looked like without like houses and farms and everything else. You know what I mean? Like everything looks like it's just got a coat of moss over it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and it's everything looks like it could be like an ornate painting in a storybook.
Yeah,
like go
like
look at
Thomas Kincaid painting or something like
that. Or go look at the movie poster for it. The movie poster is on our website. It's part of this episode. The film looks like the movie poster. And that's rare for fantasy films, but the art of the poster really captures what the movie feels like.
Yeah, and the armor was always like really gleaming on them and stuff like that. And you're like, wow, this is really cool. And even some of the special effects that they were doing, like with the Holy Grail, and how the Grail would like fill itself up, you know, and stuff like that. It was like really cool.
The Excalibur would have like a slightly animated green sheen to it.
Yeah, it always looked like a little more special than just like a regular
sword.
Yeah,
they actually rotoscoped some green animation on top of it to make it shimmer in an unnatural way.
Right.
Just subtly, and it looked cool.
Yeah, I mean,
the movie, despite again being sparse, is beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
But let's see. It's hard to not watch the movie and just immediately think of Monty Python and the Holy Grail the entire time.
It's hard not to, and especially since you know the names. I mean, the Sir Lancelot and, you know, this guy, Sir, you know, whatever, all the knights and stuff like that.
And when you see them riding away from like Camelot in the distance, you think, it's only a model, or they make the round table. You imagine like the song, or Knights of the Round Table.
Yeah.
You just can't help it, you know.
Right? All this stuff is very iconic. Like looking. Oh, there was even one scene where a guy, like in battle, where his arm gets cut off, and like the blood spurts out of it.
And it's almost, just like the Black Knight scene from Monty Python.
It's like, oh, it's just a bunch of scratch. You know, you're just like, oh my God, that was like just like the same thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, so I mean, mostly, I mean, of course, since it's 81, it's all practical effects and stuff like that. But yeah, I thought it was great. The weird thing was that I thought the guy that played Merlin, what was his name?
Let's see here. Let me pull my cast list.
The guy that played Merlin was cracking me up. He was what like really like made me laugh.
He's almost in a different movie.
Yeah, and the way he would talk was, you know, he would change his voice like all the time. So sometimes he would be up here. Sometimes he would be down. You know.
And sometimes in the same scene.
In the same sentence almost, like just change and you want da. And you're like, what is going on with this guy's voice? Like, it's so weird.
His name is Nicole Williamson.
Right. Nicole Williamson. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've actually got that in my notes for something else. But he was just like, he was really tripping me up. Like,
yeah. At some points, he like has like goofy moments where he mugs for the camera. And like, it's kind of a little bit silly.
Yeah.
And you're like, and nothing else in the movie is like that. It's just him. It's an odd choice.
And it's almost like he, you know, like appears out of nowhere and disappears out of nowhere.
Like he'll just walk into scenes and walk back out again.
Yeah.
And again, it makes it feel like a stage play. Like he's walking off. He's walking off the side of the stage.
Here's the magician. Poof. There goes the magician.
Like he falls to the trap door in the scene, you know. Yeah. Or he walks off stage behind the curtain.
Yeah,
know?
No, that he's not like, okay, I'm going to go to my house. All right, bye. You know, like, you know what I mean? It's not like
he just drops in and out of the story constantly.
Yeah.
It sounds like we're ragging on this movie, and we are a little bit,
but it's just interesting and fun. Well, I think it's just the odd quirks of comparing like a movie that we've seen of today. And comparing it sort of like to the quirks like of 81. And you have to remember, like, this is all, you know, like fantasy. It's a little bit, you know, cartoony in the way that, you know, like even Merlin is a really sort of cartoony, like kind of character or whatever. And even what happens in it is all like really weird. But it is like we say, like it's these snippets of like odd, you know, sort of, you know, fantasy. And I mean, it really is the most fantasy like that I've seen, you know. And also I think it's a really great telling of the legend of Arthur.
It's a really good Cliff Notes version of all those stories.
And I thought it was incredibly, even though that it's like 2 hours long, it's really, or even longer than that. I think it's two hours and 20 minutes. Yeah. I mean, it's very entertaining from start to finish.
Well,
stuff
is always happening.
Yeah.
Because it's so kind of fragmented, there's no like the, all like the quiet times are completely removed from it. Mm-hmm. Like someone's always either getting stabbed or there's magic or there's nudity.
Yeah.
And it's all this kind of just wacky stuff, or Merlin's mugging for the camera. Something is always happening, or there's beautiful scenery,
or beautiful
armor, or cool fight scenes. There's always something there to hold your attention.
Right. Well, I mean, and you're following like the very dramatic arc of, you know, Arthur's birth all the way to his death.
Yeah.
I mean, and everything that was very significant, which was a lot of dramatic stuff. Yeah. I mean, because obviously, I mean, any, you know, like just everything that happens, you know what I mean?
It's kind of like
all these love triangles and all these weird, like, you know, with the father, like in the mother and the Organa and Merlin and, you know.
We didn't even talk about the fact that Morgana sleeps with her brother to make an evil prince to fight King Arthur at the end of the movie.
Yeah, her half brother.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, but she does the same thing as what Uther, her, you know, Arthur's dad did, was, you know, Organa, like, master self.
Yeah, tricks him.
Yeah, as Guinevere, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Basically date rape King Arthur. And
meanwhile, Guinevere's off with Lancelot, like, doing their thing in the forest.
Again, it's such a horny movie.
You can definitely tell it was made by a guy.
you really can.
Yeah. It is a guy's movie for sure. I mean, it's not something that I would want to like sit and watch with my wife and go, "Oh, let's watch this movie about Arthur."
Yeah, I'd be like, if I told my girlfriend I liked fantasy movies and this is what we watch, you just look at me and be like, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Fantasy, huh?
Yeah. I did like the ending scene where, you know, Arthur tells
Percival
to go like throw the thing.
You should
in the
know
leg.
Percival, you're a Ready Player One fan.
Sorry. I was distracted by the computer. Okay, sorry. I'm actually trying to do two things at once.
Don't ruin the illusion of the show, Ryan.
Being an engineer, you know, sound engineer and host.
You wear many hats.
But yeah, but Percival, he tells Percival to go throw the Excalibur in the lake. And then, you know, he comes back and says, no, I couldn't do it. And he's like, no, do as I say, because the next king will pick it up, blah, blah, blah. So, and then when Percival comes back, like, he's being carried off, like, you know, on a raft by, like, these, like, angelic, you know,
nuns
things
or whatever. Yeah.
It really reminded me of the end of, like, The Lord of the Rings or
yes.
whatever, yeah.
Why do you say that?
Yeah, I know, but, I know.
But I gotta say, you mentioned...
Hint,
you mentioned Percival. I kind of wish the movie had been about Percival. I found him to be the most interesting character in the film.
Yeah.
He's kind of, he goes from being a nobody squire to being the one who finds the Grail. He's, in a lot of ways, he's Arthur's loyalist friend in the end.
Yeah.
And
he's the one who actually gets the Grail or whatever, yeah, at the end.
And he has some of the best scenes in the entire film. I kind of wish this part had been expanded even more.
Mm-hmm.
But again, it's not really a movie that's concerned with narrative. It's just concerned with giving you interesting things to look at.
Yeah.
And that's fine.
Right. But Percival's journey, I think, was more towards the Grail and stuff like that. Like his actual quest and stuff like that. Yeah, I found that interesting. He's like, he got really close, but he was like asking all those questions and he didn't know how to answer what what is this for?
Well, the character that always doubts is always the most interesting, you know?
Right. Yeah. But yeah, I like the whole thing. I mean, even though it was kind of weird and kind of kooky and kind of...
It's definitely unique.
Yeah.
I mean, there's not many movies that feel like this except for Monty Python and the Holy Grail of all things.
Yeah. I mean, and even that, I mean, they're poking fun of it. But yeah, Monty Python, it's almost like this is Star Wars and Monty Python is like, you know, Spaceballs.
If Spaceballs
you know.
Had come out first, which is just mind blowing.
It's really, really
like, like brain just explodes.
All right. Well, let's get on to the facts and stuff. What do you say?
Let's do it, my friend.
All right. You're going to like this a lot. For Lady Hawk, you know, so Matthew Broderick plays the lead.
Mm-hmm.
Kurt Russell was originally cast to play the
main. He probably would have been so much better.
Or what do you think?
Yeah, well, I mean, because I just had to think he would have been.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Not as Matthew Broderick, but as Rutger Hauer.
I don't know. That'd be hard to say. Rutger Hauer is really good in Lady Hawk.
Right.
He's probably the strongest actor in the film.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
But okay, so here's what happened. Kurt Russell was originally cast as the male lead for Rutger. Which who plays the wolf or Navarre?
Yeah, Navarre. Yeah.
All right, and apparently like things weren't going so well like on when they first started shooting.
Yeah.
So Rutger Hauer, which originally cast to play the evil captain, but he expressed interest in playing Navarre. Mm. So when Kurt Russell said, "Yeah, I don't know if this is really for me."
There's wolves and birds. I don't get this.
It's like fantasy. Like I don't know where we're going here. This isn't like a Disney type fantasy thing. So
yeah.
I'm out. So we got. So Rucker moved over to play Navarre.
Huh. Oh. Would have been a very different movie.
Yeah. Philippe's role. Now we're talking about Philippe, like Matthew Broderick.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was also offered to Sean Penn and Dustin Hoffman, and even Curtis Armstrong. Yeah.
Booger?
Know, yes.
Booger would have been great in it.
Booger would have been fantastic.
Booger, and Booger would have. Well, actually, you give Curtis Armstrong more strength. Curtis would have fit the role perfectly.
Yeah, Curtis would have been awesome. Yeah. That would have been a real like cult classic to me. And... I mean, I don't know what they didn't see. Matthew Broderick, I guess, was like kind of a rising star at the time.
Heartthrob at the time, yeah.
Sorry, Curtis, but we thought you would have been great in it.
Yeah.
If
you want to be on our show, Curtis, reach out to us. We're very pro you on this show.
very pro Curtis Armstrong. The second movie with Matthew Broderick and John Wood. So John Wood played the bishop, and he also played in War Games.
It's true, he did.
Yeah. He played, why is my brain, like, failing me? I need more coffee. Hold on.
Okay.
I need more coffee. Hold on.
Take a nice audible sip. Damn good coffee.
Yeah, damn good coffee. But Joshua's dad, what's his name? I still can't think of his name.
I don't know the character's name. I'm not a huge War Games person, so.
I should know that. Falcon.
Oh, yeah.
Professor Falcon.
Yes.
I knew it would come to me. My 40-plus-year-old brain is failing me, you guys.
Okay. We're slowly reaching the grave. That's all it is.
And it's one of my favorite movies.
Yeah, we're just slowly rotting, man. Don't worry about it.
I know. Maybe I should play more, you know, chess or Falcon's Maze or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
Just to keep
up. Stop watching all these damn movies.
Yeah, exactly. Stop rotting my brain, messing with computers, you know, staring at a computer screen all day. Yeah. All right. So the film score. Okay. So one of the things that we failed to mention in talking about Lady Hawk was the film score.
Oh, God. How did you let me forget that? Lady Hawk has the worst film score. I despise the score for Lady Hawk.
It's very synth, like 80s, you know, synthy, you know, for like this, you know.
It's like 50, four Casio keyboards.
Right. It's supposed to be like the 16th century, like sort of, you know.
And you've got like flock of seagulls, yeah, like just tinkering away.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, it is so jarring.
Yeah. So it's composed by Andrew Powell and Alan Parsons.
Alan Parsons.
All right. Powell is an arranger and member of the Alan Parsons Project and also worked with artists such as the Hollies, Kansas, and Kate Bush. Alan Parsons is an engineer and producer that has worked on the Beatles' Abbey Road, Let It Be, and also Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon, as well as his own group, the Alan Parsons Project, which Alan Parsons Project, many of you know, it's the it is the Chicago Bulls, like, intro music. Like, the very spacey do-do-do-do-do-do-do. That's Alan Parsons' project.
It's so very, you have any idea of what Lady Hawk sounds like.
And, and I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but Alan Parsons' project, that also is, like, he's kind of considered the godfather of, like, atmospheric, you know, or trance music, right?
Yeah. It's kind of like the first guy to do that.
Right. Yeah. Especially trance. Yes. Right, yeah. That whole genre of electronica or whatever.
But it does not work with wizards and swords.
Well, Powell combined traditional orchestral music and Gregorian chants with contemporary progressive rock. It was a very much an abandonment of like movie score producers such as like John Williams and James Horner. You know,
was a mistake. This movie would have been so much better with a John Williams or a James Horner type score, or like a Basil Panduras score. You know, something with like strings and real drums.
I can't tell you. I mean, I kind of agree with you there.
Oh, the score is the worst part. I can't believe I forgot to mention it. The score is the worst part of Lady Hawk.
Yeah.
It's bad.
You just don't want to hear an 80s synth when you're watching some, like, you know, 13th century, like, you know.
When I started the movie to watch it, it's so bad in the opening credits, I nearly turned it off. Like, it's hard to get through the opening credits.
Yeah, it's really sort of bad. Well, here's the thing. Here's how it all sort of came to be, okay? Richard Donner stated he was listening to the Alan Parsons Project while scouting for locations and was unable to separate his visual ideas from the music. So you can blame Alan Parsons Project because they filmed it a lot in like Northern Italy and stuff like that. Like where a lot of these like castle ruins are and stuff like that. And he was driving around like, you know, these far reaches of the mountains in Italy and was listening to the Alan Parsons Project of all
things.
Which
is weird because it doesn't fit the movie at all.
No, but to Richard Donner it did. Warner Brothers falsely marketed the movie Lady Hawk as being a true medieval legend. Edward Karma, who was the writer, took issue to the Writers Guild Association and was awarded a cash settlement from Warner Brothers, but the medieval legend claim wasn't dropped.
Hmm.
Yeah.
That's weird.
Yeah, it's all weird.
Like, why would that be a selling point to people? You're like, let's just see the movie based on that real legend.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. But I think the guild, like, pays less money if it's, like, based on...
I think it's adapted, yeah.
Adapted, so it was like, no, he's like, he wrote it as original,
yeah.
But they market it as, you know, this kind of stuff. But anyway, three of the castles used for the film were owned by Italian film director Luchino Visconti and his family.
Don't know him.
Don't know who that is. Nominated for 2 Academy Awards for Best Sound Editing and Best Sound.
Well, the sound is good. I mean, I like the horse footsteps, the crunching of snow, the clanging of swords.
Yeah, the clanging of swords in Lady Hawk was awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, those swords, that sword that he had, that like really badass like family sword that he had was like super duper, man. Those were like some really steel swords, man.
Yeah, they felt hefty.
I mean, Matthew Broderick looked like he had trouble getting that thing around.
I'm sure it was probably heavy. You know?
Right. So, yeah, I mean, the sound is pretty good. The sound is really unique. I mean, I listen to it. Like, I listen to a lot of these. Like, I watch a lot of these movies with, like, headphones. And, yeah, I was really captured by the sound. I mean, there was a lot of, like, nature sounds. And, you know, it really kind of, like, draws you in. So, like I said, the two Academy Awards that actually won for those two categories in 1985 for Best Sound Editing and Best Sound... Best Sound Editing went to Back to the Future. I mean, obviously,
yeah.
And then the Best Sound went to a movie called Out of Africa,
which I've never seen but heard of. So
yeah, it's one of those. It's one of the. It's a really great movie. I've seen it. I mean, it's. But yeah, it's one of those like Academy, you know, sort of
Oscar bait kind of movies.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The budget for Lady Hawk was $20 million and the box office $18.4 million.
Yikes.
Yeah, not so good. Roger Ebert, he didn't give it a review, but says it's one of his favorite Richard Donner films.
It's a fun movie.
Mm-hmm. So just to give you an idea what the critics thought about it, this movie at the time, the New York Times called the film divided against itself and went on to say that the scenes of high adventure or... of visual splendor are spliced between other scenes with dialogue of a banality.
Kind of fair.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not the greatest dialogue, no. I don't think. Rotten Tomatoes critic score was 64%.
I can't argue with that.
Audience, 74%.
People like it.
Right. I think they're like, the people that award it are like you, they grew up watching it.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like... you know, I put it in the same sort of category as, like we mentioned, like The Princess Bride.
Yeah. People like fairy tales.
Right.
That's it is at its base what it is.
Right. It is a very fairy tale-ish type of movie, for sure. All right. So let's move on to Excalibur. Good one.
Excalibur.
1981. John Borman, the director, originally sought out to make a film adaptation of Merlin the Legend in 1969. When submitting the script to United Artists, they deemed it too costly and said, well, why don't you make Lord of the Rings instead? Mm-hmm. So we'll fund Lord of the Rings, so you get started on that. So he's like, okay. So they started doing stuff. They started making deals, started doing all this stuff. They could never secure the rights to do Lord of the Rings, so United Artists dropped it. They said, well, you can do whatever you want.
We already have these costumes.
Yeah,
these
we already sets. Started building like all this stuff because we knew we're going to have to get all this stuff because you have to get like a lot of people, you know, because you're making all this armor, you're doing all this stuff. So eventually, Borman was allowed to shop the script elsewhere and return to his original ideas and secured deals for Excalibur. Mm-hmm. So part of like the making, like they made some of the sets and they made a lot of the armor and a lot of the stuff like. To make Lord of the Rings.
And it shows. Like, I mean, like the villain's armor, like the bag armor, looks monstrous.
Yeah, it looks very sort of gorish. It looks, you know, like a, like orc would wear or something like that.
They have weird like monster shapes to like the helmets and like. Like,
and it's very dark and black.
And like soot covered.
Yeah.
And like the hero armor is very, like I said, it's not in any way realistic. It's got huge like flaring fins and like it looks very high fantasy. Like no armor ever looked like this in real life.
No. And no, that's not at part all. Of they had this like, the one thing I love about it was they had these collars, right? Like around the side, yeah, you know.
These hyphen collars that were, I guess the idea was to protect from swords.
Yeah.
And it looks cool.
Yeah.
But it just doesn't seem very practical. And that's not what they had at all back then.
No,
But it's ornate and they're beautiful to look at.
I think it's one of the most. And then even his son, like, I don't forget what Arthur's like.
Mordred,
yeah. Like his
golden armor.
His golden armor was like really weird.
And his helmet looked like a mask with hair.
Exactly.
It was all made out of like gold.
That was the one telltale sign. Yeah, that looks like Lord of the Rings to me.
Yeah. It's very not traditional like Arthurian style. It looks very outlandish.
Right.
That's the word, outlandish.
Right.
It's just extra.
Right.
You know, like Merlin's wearing like a metal cap on his head for some reason.
Yeah, like it's covering his whole scalp, but it's like kind of pointy. So it's like where his actual hair would be, but it's like this shiniest, you know, metal scalp that fit like just perfectly on his head.
Yeah, and you can totally like imagine like Saruman from Lord of the Rings wearing that, you know, or like the orcs wearing like their real dingy monster armor, or like the men of Gondor wearing this bright, shiny, you know, ornate, beautiful armor.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And even the sets, like things that we would see in Lord of the Rings, just a very stripped down version of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, some of those, like the final battle scene, kind of looked like, you know, reminiscent of like Helm's Deep or something like that.
It really does.
Yeah.
But just like really, really smaller budget.
Yeah. Smaller, sparse, like not as many people kind of thing.
Yeah, but if you go into it knowing that all the costumes and stuff were designed for Lord of the Rings, you can't help but see it in every scene.
Right. Yeah. And I think that I watched like half the movie. Like I watched it like, you know, like the first hour or like one night because I just can't watch movies like, with kids and.
We get sleepy kids is what we're trying to say.
Well, my schedule's weird, but no, so I have to watch these like late at night after my kids are already to bed, right? So I don't want to like stay up till midnight on a weeknight to watch these movies, right? So I'll watch them a little bit at a time sometimes, or I'll split them in half. And I was like, so the second day I came in and you were like, yeah, you know, this was made for like Lord of the Rings. Like you already knew that trivia. And I was like, I'll watch the second half. I was like, holy crap, like I totally see that now.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you can totally see it. But what struck me, what's more, I guess, sort of like astounding about that bit of trivia to me is can you imagine what Borman like would have done with the Lord of the Rings?
Yeah.
Not to say that he's you can definitely tell he's much more passionate about the Arthur and the Merlin story, but like, what if we had like the Lord of the Rings version?
I always found the idea of movies that didn't happen to be interesting. And John Borman's Lord of the Rings is one I've often wondered about. Like, what would that have been like? How would it have changed movie making? Would it have been a big hit? Would it have been forgotten? You know, what would it have been?
Well,
Lord of the Rings eventually came out here, eventually in the early 2000s. It was a huge hit.
Well, it would have been one movie.
Yeah.
It would have been a much smaller battle scenes like we saw. I mean, I think that you can kind of watch this and kind of get an idea.
It probably would have been fragmented, too. It would have been like the Lord of the Rings highlights.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. You wouldn't get all of the story.
It probably would have had Billy Barty in it as one of the hobbits, you know, and Noodles McIntosh from UHF.
All right. So let's move on. The film was originally, like the of Excalibur was originally 3 hours long. So he had to, like, when it was first released, they cut it down to 140 minutes and carried an R rating, okay? So they made a second cut for a 120-minute version, which cut out, like, the sexy scenes and some of the, like, gruesome battle scenes and made it PG ratings. And what the crazy thing is, you know, you and I talk about, like, watching movies during this time period and, like, the early 80s and the mid-80s. and watching it on HBO, right? Like, we would catch movies on HBO.
Yeah.
And, you know, because they just, like, play movies throughout the day. Well, and about the night. Well, they didn't play rated R movies until after, like, 8 or 9 o'clock. Yeah. So HBO would run the rated R version, like, after 9, and would run, like, the PG version, like, during the day.
I can see the PG version being really boring. If you cut out the gore and the nudity, you lose a lot of the movie.
You can still have, I mean, because it kind of eludes, but, you know.
But the idea that HBO had PG edits of movies to show during the day makes me wonder if about all the movies we've watched on this show that we grew up watching on HBO, where we go back and watch them now, and I'm like, I don't remember there being nudity in this movie.
Well, I mean, there's always, like, TV versions. I know they cut out scenes, you know, of TV versions, and there's always the warning that says, hey, this has been modified, you know, whatever.
But it makes me wonder if some of these movies that I misremember are because I saw them on HBO in, like, edited versions, maybe, when I was a kid.
Because, well, you would think that HBO wouldn't have an edited version. Yeah. Like, it would have the same version as the theatrical version.
You would think. But right. That kind of makes me second guess all that stuff now.
Right. Well, I still think that it's still kind of interesting how they...
No, it is,
you
know, interesting.
Well, because the studio did it. Yep. HBO didn't, like, request... Yeah. A PG version. It's just that I think the studio that released it was like, you know, they, you know, remember at the time there was no PG-13. It was either R or PG. And if it was R, you can only make so much movie. That's it wasn't true. Until Beverly Hills Cop, like, we proved, like, it wasn't really until, like, those type of movies could you really make a profit on, you know, big profits on rated R movies.
And again, if you want to hear our Beverly Hills Cop episode, it's available in our archives at video-culture.com.
Okay. So, moving on. Borman specifically cast Helen Mirren and Nicole William opposite of each other because they had run-ins before during a production of Macbeth, and they hated each other, and they were, like, on non-speaking terms.
Yeah.
So it's like they're supposed to be sort of at odds with one another, so he specifically cast them.
And you can feel the tension between Morgana and Merlin in those scenes.
Yeah. They have the, like, really quick, like, you know, quips between
kind of
them.
Kind of a snappiness to it. Yeah,
exactly. But... after this film, they actually became friends.
Aww.
Yeah. Isn't that great?
Yeah.
Yeah. Helen Mirren is fantastic.
She is. Well, a huge Helen Mirren fan.
Yes. Very much so. So, Borman, let's see. I've already said that one. Sean Connery was briefly attached to play King Arthur.
That probably would have made it better.
Well, he did play Arthur in First Knight in 1995.
He did, like, which is a more, like, standard adaption of the Arthurian legend.
Yeah.
It's more of a romantic film. Yeah.
Yeah, more romantic, especially, it's supposed to be a little more historical, slightly, but it's still more romantic.
It's
less fantasy, more about the love story between him and Guinevere.
It definitely dials down the weirdness. Like, yeah, it's not a weird movie. Excalibur's a weird film.
Oh, for sure. It stars Richard Gere as Lancelot and Sean Connery as Arthur. Mm-hmm. The initial fight scene had to be filmed 3 times. It was filmed at night, and all the film came out underexposed due to a fault in the exposure meter. The cameraman, because of all this, had a nervous breakdown over the issue and quit the film.
That'd be a lot of work, having to redo that kind of stuff, you know?
Well, and that's a lot of pressure, man, you know?
And because back then...
You can't help but a faulty, you know, light meter or whatever.
And that's something that was so nerve-wracking about making films back then before the advent of digital. You didn't know what you were getting until it came back from development.
No.
So you could have wasted days of filming.
Right.
And that's why, nothing usable.
Right, and that's why they had dailies, because they would quickly send it off, you know, to be developed overnight, and then come back with the dailies, which was just on standard, like, VHS or whatever.
Yeah.
Like a really crappy version, really crappy.
Just,
like,
to get an idea of what they had.
Yeah, what they had, yeah. But anyway, but poor cameraman. They're under a lot of pressure, man. They're under a lot of pressure. Okay, so the new cameraman, he had to wait for several days for the shot of the crow eating a dead knight's eye.
Which is one of the cooler shots in the entire movie, honestly.
Yeah, they really is. I mean, so what they had wasn't, like, really set up. Like, you know, in a set. They really had just had to sit there and just wait for this crow to come eat this thing.
To pick up this prop eye. And it's cool in the film. I wondered how they did it. So, it's good. It's interesting to know that they just waited for it to happen naturally.
Yeah, they just, like, shot. I guess they were just, like, waiting, you know, and it was just like, okay, just, you know, cut the camera on when the crow comes. Yeah. And they just had to just wait, you know. That's crazy. It was a lot of the film, like a lot of the films are a lot of the film was shot in Ireland, and they had to use like Irish extras and stuff like that. So when they yelled cut, they didn't always stop fighting. they didn't always want to stop fighting. And so they asked him why, and they said, to settle old scores, they said.
And I'm sure it's kind of fun swinging, like, rubber weapons, and you're wearing this, like, armor. You know you're going to get hurt, you know?
Yeah. And then we're like, you know, like, oh, yeah, I'm going to fight you. You get on that side, you get on that side. Okay, we're going to really fight, you know?
Like, funny.
Yeah, you stole my girlfriend, man, right? Or, like, you know. Yeah, it's hilarious. So we talked about the armor and how ornate it was. It was made by a guy named Terry English, who went on to design the armor for Aliens. So his work. I mean, and I've heard that, you know, the stuff in Aliens, like their actual suits and stuff like that, like their armor.
It looks very realistic and tactical. Yeah,
it looks like really, really cool. It was, Excalibur was only nominated for one Academy Award for Best Cinematography. It lost to a movie called Reds.
Never heard of it.
I don't know.
You think it would have gotten a Best Costuming nod? I mean,
yeah,
that's wild. That's
weird. One other thing that I didn't have in my notes, but, that I remember reading is that most of the scenes, like it was raining that day or whatever. And so that's one of the reasons that it gives like the look to the film is because it really, that's like the lush sort of like nature, like when it rains, so everything's kind of glistening and everything else. But also they said that like the armor was awful because they had to like wipe it down in between scenes and stuff like that.
That sounds like it'd be horrible to work with. You know?
Right. But that's also, I think, one of the reasons why it looks so great is because it's like
they're constantly polishing it off.
Yeah, exactly. Roger Ebert gave Excalibur, he only gave it 2.5 stars.
Huh.
Yeah.
What did he say about it?
He said it is both a wondrous vision and a mess.
Completely accurate.
He says a record of the comings and goings of arbitrary, inconsistent, shadowy figures who are not heroes, but simply giants run amok. Still, it's wonderful to look at.
It's completely accurate.
Completely. I think it's funny how I sit there and say, yeah, this is a great movie. It looks great. And then Roger Ebert's like, yeah, you know, he agrees with, you know, my thoughts. You know, it's really fascinating. I love what I do. I love getting to do this and watch these old movies. Rotten Tomatoes critic score, 79%.
It's a pretty well-regarded film.
An audience, 80%.
I know a lot of people who love this one. I had never seen it before, but I had a lot of friends who were like, oh, man, you got to watch Excalibur.
Right, and I think this is the one movie, like, I mean, that, like I said, 1 or 2% audience and critics, you know, not, they're 1% off.
Yeah.
I mean, they're very right on there, you know what I mean? It's
well, I think that is clear that what the movie excels at, it obviously excels at. What it fails at, it's very clear that it fails at. So there's not a lot of ground for like, oh, I don't think that at all. Everyone can kind of see that it's apparent where it wins and loses, you know?
Right. And like I said, as a movie, it's still real enjoyable as this like fantasy where you get caught up in, you know, Arthur's life and these knights and, you know, this like sort of weird, you know, sort of tale, you know what I mean?
Yeah. I'm glad I watched it. Yeah, for sure.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm glad I rewatched Lady Hawk.
Yeah.
Which brings us to the question we always ask.
All right.
If you were to rent these from the video store, would you keep them an extra day or would you return them on time?
Okay. Lady Hawk, probably return. I'm sorry.
No. I haven't given my answer yet.
Okay. So. All right.
What about Excalibur?
Excalibur, I'd probably keep Excalibur.
Fair enough. All right. For me, I would actually return them both on time.
Right, okay.
Yeah, I mean, because I think they have good qualities, but they are both two very deeply flawed films.
Okay.
I like lots of things about both of them. There are lots of things I dislike about both of them. To me, they're almost the epitome of, it was good. Glad I watched it.
Okay.
Nothing else to say about it. but of course, yeah. We have to, because that's the point of the show. But yeah, there are movies that have really good things and really bad things about them, and there's not a lot in between.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that kind of makes it them both sort of messes.
I see.
So, yeah. Well, I think there's things to recommend about them. Neither of them are what I would call great.
Okay. That's fair. That's fair.
Yeah.
I think I like most, not just the history of the filmmaking and stuff like that, but I like the lore of the Arthur legend.
Sure.
And, we don't have anything like that in the United States at all. Like, what do you have? Like, Paul Bunyan and
Johnny
like,
Appleseed? That stuff's lame.
It's lame. Like, Paul Bunyan just has, like, a big blue ox and, like, you know, like, and Davy Crockett, like,
yeah.
I mean, like, we don't have anybody like Arthur. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The closest ones are, George Washington or Lincoln.
Which is weird.
Because Arthur's based on a real person, right?
Yes. Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, because we get ideas like George Washington, like, oh, cut down an apple tree and all this other kind of
cherry
stuff.
Cherry tree,
yeah. Yeah, cherry tree or whatever the deal, you know.
But it's not nearly as cool and dramatic as, like, a sword-fighting, like, leader who battles dragons and evil wizards and, you know.
Has this great and powerful sword that he can command, like, the power of God and all this kind of stuff.
Who gets molested by his half-sister for some reason, but we won't talk about that part.
Yeah, but, I mean, no, just to, but yeah, I like sort of, like, that part of it, you know, really. I mean, and really, I think that it really, like, sort of, like, tells all of those parts and pieces and puts it all together to where you can really understand it. Because, like, you hear, like, the story of, like, you know, the sword and the stone, and you hear kind of the idea of, like, you know, the search for the Holy Grail, and you hear the story about Guinevere and, you know, whatever. But, like, to put it all together in one whole movie, that's what it, I mean...
Like I say, and to me, it's enjoyable. It's just it's very deeply flawed.
Yeah.
And like I say, but it's totally worth watching. Don't get me wrong; it is worth the rental. I don't think I'd keep it forever. You know.
Okay.
So, do you have any recommendations?
Gosh, I didn't even think
as we
about
wind
that.
Down.
I did, and I totally forgot.
It's okay. I think
go ahead with yours.
So obvious when we mentioned in the show, you have to watch with Excalibur. You have to double it up with Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
Yeah,
you have to.
Right. Yeah,
you have to. You have to.
Yeah.
But as far as my real recommendation, I'm going to recommend a movie that came out in the late '90s. Stars Dennis Quaid and Sean Connery. Called Dragonheart.
Oh, yeah.
It's got some spidey CGI, and there are a bunch of unnecessary sequels, but it's a good little romp. It fit tonally very well with Lady Hawk.
Mm-hmm.
It's that kind of vibe, kind of light,
yeah,
a little bit of a fairy tale.
Yeah.
But you got sword and sorcery again,
right?
Dragons and, you know, heroes.
Right.
It's a movie that no one really talks about anymore because, like, the terrible direct-to-video sequels kind of damaged the brand, but the original film...
Mm-hmm.
Spidey CGI side is fun and enjoyable, and you know it's worth an hour and a half of your time.
Okay, that's fair. That's a really really good one. I like that one. I don't think I have any.
You don't. It's okay. And you don't like, have it's to. Really because is there really any better film to watch than Monty Python and the Holy Grail?
Yeah, I have seen. You know, Arthur, like the one that we mentioned with Sean Connery and Richard Gere.
Yeah.
I mean, I think as far as the Arthur legend movie, I think that one's also like worth a spin or worth a play.
Anything with Sean Connery is not going to be totally terrible. Yeah.
No, I mean, and even though he has such like Sean Connery, you know, he doesn't change his accent, even though he's playing, you know, Arthur, he's still got like his Irish, like,
I've never heard him not talk like Sean Connery
or Scottish. Sorry, excuse me. A lot of people are going to bash me over the head. his Scottish, even though he doesn't lose his Scottish accent playing Arthur, it's still a, you know, it's still a good movie.
Yeah, it's certainly enjoyable. I mean, it shows all the ways you can tell the King Arthur legend for sure. Yeah. Like it's so malleable and it's open to so many different interpretations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I almost think that, and this is one last thing I'll say about Excalibur, is that I almost think that in 1975, like, Monty Python and the Holy Grail came out. You know, because all these kids, like, they learn the Arthur legend stories, you know, as a kid growing up and all this other kind of stuff, and children's books and stories and whatnot. And then you have Monty Python and the Holy Grail, and it's like, maybe Richard Donner got tired of, like, these kids learning the history.
You mean
Richard
Borman.
John Borman got tired of, these kids learning Arthur history from, you know, Monty Python, that he was like, well, let's have a real Arthur movie. We're going to do an Arthur movie. Let's do one for real. Yeah. You know what I mean?
But it's still weird how visually it feels so of the same piece. Yeah. It's just fascinating to me.
Yeah.
Like, to me, it's almost the most fascinating discovery about this entire endeavor was how those two movies link up.
Yeah. They do have a very similar, you know, look and feel to them, for sure.
They really do.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm looking forward to next week.
Me too.
Or next episode.
Well, on next episode in 2 weeks, mm-hmm. we're going to talk about what I consider, again, one of the video store icons.
Okay.
A director by the name of Joe Dante.
Joe Dante. Some of you, the two movies is I almost forgot again, but it's Inner Space and
a movie that we both love that stars America's dad before he was America's dad,
mm-hmm.
Mr. Tom Hanks, called The Burbs.
The Burbs. Yeah, this will be our first like Tom Hanks movie for sure. Right?
What
is it? Is there a second one?
Don't disrespect Pep Strebeck.
Oh, right. I can't like Dragnet.
We're going to get all the weird Tom Hanks like early goofy comedies done on this show, apparently.
Oh, I know. We need to do a Man with One Red Shoe. We need to do Money Pit. Money Pit's one of my favorites.
Yeah.
Two movies I've seen.
Yes.
We've gone like a whole month, like two movies that I haven't seen. Like, I've never seen this movie. And don't get me wrong, I love getting introduced to movies that I haven't seen, especially that are great, that I really like. And one of the reasons, like I said, one of the reasons I like doing the show, but sometimes it's good just to go with something that is familiar.
Yeah,
you know?
Just to get to rewatch. Because part of the fun of movies is getting to rewatch movies.
Yeah.
And Inner Space is so much fun. The Burbs is so much fun. It's going to be a good episode. And if anyone doesn't know those movies or doesn't know Joe Dante, watch them. You're in for a treat in 2 weeks.
All right. Well, that about wraps it up for us here on Video Culture. I'm Ryan Acree.
And I'm Matthew Estrie. Go watch some movies, guys.
Thanks for checking out this episode of Video Culture. You can check us out on Twitter at Video Culture 2.
That's the number 2 for two guys talking about movies like Ryan and myself.
And you can also check us out on Facebook. Just search for Video Culture Podcast.
Also, be sure to stop by our official website, video-culture.com. There we have the entire show archives, as well as articles about film.
Yeah, so check us out. We'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, coming out with us, talk movies. Did you like the show? Do you hate the show? Do you like or hate the movies we talked about? Let us know. Come chat with us and let's all watch movies together.
The Wizard's Ancient Spell.
Into the eyes of the dragon and in despair.
And the lust of a lord.
I must have her. One night with her.
Give birth to an empire.
Behold the sword of power, Excalibur.
The future has taken root in the present. It is done.
Orion Pictures presents John Borman's Excalibur.
Knights of the Round Table, we shall always come together in a circle to hear and tell of deeds good and brave. And I will marry.
Don't you know me, Merlin? Because I'm a creature like you.
Their magic is Merlin.
Are you just a dream to some?
A nightmare to others!
Their king is Arthur.
You are my husband.
I must be king first.
Their power is Excalibur.
I swear eternal faith to Arthur, king.
Sir Lancelot, you will be my champion.
What is that? Greatest quality of knighthood.
True.
We're high evil then.
Where you never expected.
I protest my innocence.
Were I not king, I would make you pay with your life.
A world of wizards, kings, warriors, queens, swords, sorcery, and desire. Forged of splendor and magic, where future meets past, flesh meets steel, and the only fear is the pain of love. Excalibur, sword of power, sword of kings.